Hi, I'm Lena Nguyen, a former New South Wales police lawyer.
And I'm Mark Davidson, a former police sniper and detective.
The lawyer, the sniper and the New South Wales police is our story, told in the hope that others who have come up against the entrenched culture of law enforcement from within might find ways to speak more openly, and so we can all make changes to the system.
So our focus is on how police responded in the aftermath of both of our stories. We're passionate about justice, and we're determined to add our voices to calls for change, so no one else is discarded as we were.
Lawyer Michael Bradley has joined us today, and we feel so fortunate to have him.
As a managing partner of Mark Lawyers, a commercial law firm with strong human rights interests, Michael has become directly involved in work for sexual assault survivors and advocacy for reform in that area of the law.
You might know him from his acerbic Twitter commentary on all things social justice, but in particular, in his advocacy with Nina Fennell as the legal partner to the Let Her Speak and Let Us Speak campaigns that brought changes to the law to allow sexual assault victims to speak freely.
He's the chair of the Rape and Sexual Assault Research and Advocacy Initiative and is widely published on legal and social justice issues and is currently representing Crikey with its fight against the Murdoch lawsuit.
So, Michael, for Mark and me, working for the New South Wales Police Force, there has been a myriad of legal issues and systems we've had to navigate. And whether someone chooses to speak up, complain, assert rights, whistleblow, either within or outside the New South Wales Police Force, it's important that person be aware of what they're likely to face, which is why we value the opportunity to talk with you today.
It's great to be here with both of you. I'm really honoured.
In my case, when the New South Wales Police Force did their own internal investigation, they decided not to criminally prosecute the police officer who raped me. And I then went to the civil courts. Something that I think is often confused by the public is the difference between being innocent of a wrongdoing and being found not guilty in the eyes of the law. Can you explain this, please, for our listeners?
Yeah, look, I think we've all seen people accused of crimes like rape walk out of court and say, I'm an innocent man, I've been declared innocent. And in fact, right up to the former Prime Minister have made declarations like that, which only add to the public confusion. It is really important for all of us to understand what the criminal justice system does and what it doesn't. It has no capacity to declare anyone innocent, and that is never the outcome of a criminal trial. What it does is it produces a finding that a person is guilty beyond reasonable doubt or not. And if the answer is not, whether that's been determined by a jury or a judge, then that's the end of the criminal process. So that accused person is not guilty of and not convicted of the crime, but it's not a declaration of innocence. And it doesn't impact on anyone's civil rights, and it doesn't impact on whether, in fact, what they were accused of doing happened.
Michael, that's incredibly relevant to my case because there are very clear distinctions between innocence and guilt in the eyes of the law versus evidence, fact, truth, and what actually happened. I entered this process in good faith, process of making the complaint to police, and the police are the ones who investigate criminal complaints, but in my case they were also my employer. And I entered into that complaints process on good faith, on the assumption and the belief and the trust that it would be done properly and fairly. Was I naive to enter it in that way?
Well, possibly. I mean, what else can you do as a survivor of crime? The police are the only avenue for criminal prosecution. There is an obvious and an inbuilt conflict when the accused person is a police officer themselves. In theory, the system is designed to deal with that, but it is a very difficult problem. I guess at one level, as a survivor whose case was not prosecuted, you're in the majority. Generally speaking, the police only prosecute in less than 10% of cases of complaint. And that is one of the unexpected consequences for survivors who subject themselves to the criminal justice process, that in fact the majority of them don't even get past the starting gate. And that is obviously a profoundly disillusioning and confronting thing to happen to anyone, where, you know, you've been raped. In the last sort of 5 years, with the Me Too movement and the growing focus on sexual violence and the encouragement of survivors to come forward, has had the ironic consequence that the rate of reporting is going up and the rate of prosecution is not. What we're seeing happen is that the police have a bigger and bigger caseload, and they are picking and choosing the cases they're taking forward to prosecution and court, and they're just taking the easiest ones to run. So it's getting actually harder from a complainant's perspective to get the police to take their case on. That is a perverse outcome. It is hideous. But the reason the police and prosecutors are so reticent about taking cases forward to prosecution is because they know what the conviction rate is. They know how hard it is to get a conviction in a rape case. It is extremely hard. It always has been.
I mean, just to play devil's advocate a little bit, speaking from my position as a former detective, like, sometimes you just don't have the evidence. And then sometimes the victims, first times they're really challenged and asked hard questions is in cross-examination. They're not often challenged when they give their versions as a victim statement. And as you rightly pointed out, sometimes the police are considering sparing the victim that hardship and trauma, additional trauma.
So these are structural flaws that drive this decision making, which in turn disincentivizes survivors from stepping forward in the first place.
I was very willing to endure the cross-examination in a criminal trial, and at my own cost and risk, I took action civilly. And I tell you what, being an applicant or a plaintiff in civil proceedings and sexual assault, and being cross-examined in my case by two barristers for nearly 4 days, before I had that experience, I thought it couldn't be as bad as a criminal trial. But in a civil matter, yeah, it's got its own challenges.
Well, in some respects worse, because you don't have the same protections that are built into the criminal justice system. So, you know, quite a number of reforms have been introduced over years to try to protect survivors from the worst excesses of cross-examination in terms of the kinds of questions they can be asked, being able to give evidence from a different room or pre-recorded. None of that exists in the civil courts. So you're actually more exposed subjecting yourself to that in cross-examination. Rape cases, of course, are peculiar in that almost always there's no evidence other than the testimony of the victim. And that's going to play out in a context where either the accused admits that there was intercourse but says it was consensual, or says it didn't happen at all. On that basis, it is hard to prove any rape case. Now, having worked with a lot of survivors who've sort of dealt with police, you know, I've seen a lot of situations where, in my view, the police are applying 19th century thinking to that decision making and bringing their own sort of personal moral views. There's a lot of victim blaming. There's a lot of irrelevant considerations brought into the mix. But, you know, by and large, in fairness, they're probably putting themselves in the shoes of a jury who are going to come in with the same set of biases. I'm not impugning the good faith of the vast majority of police officers who have to deal with these cases. And I think as dispiriting for them as it is for survivors having to try to navigate this fundamentally broken system.
Justice and accountability were a couple of my driving factors for taking my case civilly. But what justice can look like to an individual thinking about whistleblowing or making a complaint can be very personal.
So on the back of that, I'm interested to get your views on what justice might look like from your perspective.
My perspective doesn't really matter. When I work with survivors, I always am interested to find out a couple of things, and most particularly is the question of what does justice look like to them, in the sense of what is an outcome here that is a fit for what you want. A survivor starts from the position of having something been taken from them. So in the nature of crimes of sexual violence is a taking, a violation and a taking of agency. And so nothing can undo that. But the question is for the survivor, what will enable them to retake agency and get themselves into a position where they can move on with their life, where they feel that they've are able to get some form of closure or resolution to what happened to them.
There are various avenues, aren't there, Michael, to seek justice and accountability in a way that fits with a complainant's integrity and with their heart and what they need in order to find closure and the ability to move on and heal.
I haven't met a survivor for whom criminal punishment was their first priority. Now, I'm not saying that isn't the case for some, but I haven't come across one yet for whom that was like, yeah, that's what I want more than anything, is for that guy to be punished. Nor have I met a survivor for whom money was their driver, and definitely not anyone who was seeking fame. So much of the public understanding of what is driving people seeking justice is completely wrong, totally misconceived. And that's sort of, you know, one of the things that infects the public debate about this.
So increasing social media followers isn't a driving factor.
That is definitely at the bottom of the list for everyone. But there are big differences, for example, between a survivor whose abuse has been experienced in a, say, in a relationship context or a family context, as opposed to one where there was an institutional framework or in an employment situation. If you have, for example, an institution involved, as in your case, then what justice looks like has quite a different element on top of, you know, the situation of the perpetrator personally. You've got this institutional framework that was sitting there enabling, supporting, protecting and defending him and itself. So there's a whole big other picture of justice there that, from your perspective, comes into play.
So as is often said, there's many perspectives are required to get the full picture or the full truth of what's happened. For me, justice is partly about being heard in that context. During the coroner's inquest for the Lindt Cafe siege, I was called in for a day and heavily censored as to what I could be asked. So part of the reason I'm here with Lena on this podcast is to be heard and to set the record straight on behalf of the victims of the Lindt Cafe siege, you know? So do you think being heard is a common requirement or need for whistleblowers or people in situations like ours?
I think that's universal. There's nothing worse than being silenced. When you've suffered a traumatic event that was imposed on you, and you're the victim of that, and then the societal or institutional response to that is to silence you when you try to disclose, explain, expose, call out what has happened to you. That is a compounding trauma, and that is a deep, deep wound to anyone finding themselves in that situation, because there's this other imperative which is interested in silence. Profoundly damaging. If you kind of look at it objectively, as I do, the public interest in what you knew about the Lindt Cafe siege transcends everything. That is beyond question. The public needed to know and should have been told what you knew. It was a clearly extremely relevant matter that needed full exposure, and the public interest in that is obvious and compelling. Now, what would avoid that outcome? Well, that is fundamentally a process question. A process was put in place in the aftermath of the siege, which was designed ostensibly to ensure that the truth came out. It failed because the truth didn't come out. Big elements of the truth were suppressed, and the public was not informed as it ought to have been, and the lessons were not learned as they ought to have been.
You worked very closely with the Let Her Speak campaign, which involved Grace Tame, 2021 Australian of the Year. I do believe this has brought about the beginnings of a cultural shift. Victims of a broader array of sexual assaults now want to be heard. How do you think this shift might play out, and how should it play out?
Yeah, I agree that the Let Her Speak campaign, I think, was a pivotal moment. We actually managed to change the law in Tasmania, the Northern Territory and Victoria to give autonomy back to survivors to make choices for themselves about when and under what circumstances they can be identified and tell their stories under their own names. And I want to give full credit to Nina Fennell, who led the charge on that campaign. But it sort of exemplified, I guess, in a way, the way that the law has traditionally looked at survivors of sexual violence, which has been very paternalistic. So, you know, these laws that were put there supposedly to protect survivors' interests but actually took more away from them, you know, it's a pretty deeply insulting thing to do to someone. And, you know, when these provisions were created, it was all about, we need to protect survivors from the horrors of public exposure, and actually adds to the silencing of survivors and therefore of the whole issue itself.
And it sounds like those laws were premised on the incorrect assumption that the shame was attached to the complainant or the survivor.
Exactly.
And then in my case, as I went through my healing journey, I learnt, accepted, knew the shame. Yes, there was shame, but none of it was on me.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think this is the big cultural shift that we're seeing. Grace's work, Brittany, Saxon Mullins, all these incredibly brave women stepping forward and saying, it's not my shame. This ought not be my burden. I didn't do this. So that preparedness to step into the public limelight and talk about what had happened to you has shifted the conversation and shifted the social norm around sexual violence. And it started to move the burden of guilt and shame to where it ought to be, which is on the perpetrator and on the institutions that protect them. That's a work in progress. We're a long way from the end point of that. But I think, yes, that is exactly the cultural shift that's going on, and a really important one.
In my case, my former work was generally confidential and in some cases encompassed covert methodologies within the police. So I can't, and I actually won't, speak about many of these processes, particularly in relation to the siege, for example. So how do you think we can balance this to ensure that in sensitive areas people can still speak up? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it is really difficult territory, and particularly when you get into areas like policing and military and intelligence and security considerations. All of this has become extremely heightened since 9/11. There's been a tendency, certainly in Australia, to go way over in the direction of secrecy and suppression, and that is completely unbalanced at the moment because the public interest in whistleblowing and in the exposure of things that went wrong is very, very high. But the public interest in the police being able to do their job is also very, very high.
Definitely.
And so the balance point between those is difficult to find. And at the end of the day, it has to rely actually at a practical level on the integrity of individuals. Because if we invest people like you with power and authority, and we place our faith as a community in you to protect us and do things sometimes in the dark that it is actually better for us to not know about, then we are relying pretty much exclusively on your integrity and good faith, that you're going to find that balance. And that is a big burden to place on anyone, but there isn't really an alternative.
So that then comes down to community trust and integrity in our systems and government.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, any institutional authority can only operate on public faith. I mean, we have to be able to trust in the institutions of government, and that is particularly pointy when it gets to the people who have guns and take on those more existential roles of protection of the public interest. If we lose that faith and that trust, then their license to operate ceases to exist.
So how does that play out for someone like Mark, who's within the system and wants to speak out and to say this isn't working?
The police force has a set of operational values. It has principles on which it operates, and they're pretty black and white and clear. Their job is to protect the public and to serve the public and not to wield power and authority with caprice or randomly or in their own interest. And that requires the constant exercise of judgment. So as an individual police officer, you find yourself in a situation where in light of those operating values and your own kind of ethical core, you see something or experience something which is wrong, which sits outside that, then what choice do you have but to speak up?
In pursuing the right to speak or asserting the right to speak and the right to be heard, how do we know when it's time to shut up?
Yeah, that's such a good question. In Australia, we have extremely tough defamation laws, extremely tough privacy and confidentiality laws. We're not a particularly open society, frankly. You know, we have no legislated or institutionalized right of free speech in Australia. We're the only Western democracy that doesn't have that. So free speech is a residue in Australia. It's whatever's left over once laws have stopped getting in the way of it. So it's very difficult territory. And when you're in the position of a whistleblower and you're trying to expose something in the public interest, yeah, it's like navigating your way through a minefield without a map. In truth, you don't know when to shut up, and you need really, really good legal advice to help you work that out.
Well, that's a pretty remarkable way to put it, that free speech is a residue of what's left over after all the laws have enacted, and I've never really thought about it like that.
No, people usually don't. I mean, I think most Australians assume that we have a right to free speech, and they're always horrified when they discover that we don't.
So what other avenues are there to call out things like what happened to both of us?
Yeah, well, we have whistleblower laws, which are not very good. They're poorly designed. They're extremely difficult to navigate. And in most cases where someone does want to whistleblow, they're not particularly helpful. And a large part of that is because you have to go through the internal process of the institutional organisation before you can become a whistleblower and go outside the organisation to make a disclosure, which obviously exposes you to risk in terms of career and sometimes even safety. You can take the risk of going public and exposing things in that way, either directly or through the media, and taking on the legal risks that that entails.
So in terms of the inquest, I feel like the law and this confidentiality was, in a way, manipulated. Shouldn't we be able to rely on the coronial process to find the truth?
Yeah, I mean, the coronial process, because it's at arm's length, is designed to get at the truth, specifically when there's been death, to find out what was the cause of death and what were the contributing factors to that, and what are the lessons that need to be learned from that so that next time something similar happens, it won't have the same outcome. It is, however, open to manipulation because the coroner is assisted by the state, usually the police. And so the police were kind of taking the role essentially of the counsel assisting. The coroner sits there and hears what's delivered. The specific risk in that case was, of course, that it was the police themselves who were the primary subject of interrogation in that inquest. So having the police in a position where they were, in effect, playing a very central role in the construction of the evidence that was going to the coroner, there's an inbuilt conflict there. Now, my view is that that was the wrong process. Not that there shouldn't have been a coronial inquest in that case, but given the specific circumstance, the peculiar circumstances of the Lindt Cafe siege and the extremity of the public interest, a completely arm's length independent process ought to have been instituted pretty much immediately after the event in the nature of a Royal Commission or a judicial inquiry, absolutely at arm's length from the police. And really, in my view, that should have happened in that case, and I don't know why it didn't.
Now might be a good time to talk about lawyers who are instruments of the law. I am a lawyer myself, but I have no fear in calling out lawyers for their role in both pursuing justice, but also getting in the way of genuine justice. I have serious concerns about the overly aggressive and technical and aggravating manner in which the police lawyers defended their case. For example, trying to argue that the police officer who raped me wasn't technically or isn't technically an employee of the Commissioner of Police, who I was also suing. That argument got rejected. What's the role of lawyers to play here?
It's such an interesting question, and I think it's coming more and more into focus. There is a view that the role of lawyers is limited to the interests of their client. And that's the start and finish of it. So in the context of cases like yours, that is a defence for the lawyers who stand up and try to monster a rape victim into submission or into confusion, which still routinely happens in sexual violence trials for all of the reforms that have been made over the years to try to reduce the traumatic impact. Many defence counsels still set out to destroy. And they justify that on the basis that that's their job, because their job is to find reasonable doubt for their client. My view is that forgets our primary obligation as lawyers, which is to the court. We are officers of the court, and our first duty is to the court and therefore to the public interest. And that transcends our duty to our clients. So we are not and should not see ourselves just as mercenary actors in a particular secular interest. We are instrumental parts of the system itself, and we have a really significant public duty to uphold and advance the integrity of the law, which itself is just a tool of society. It's there to help society function. And if it isn't doing good, then it has no useful purpose at all. And with the holders of the toolbox. So I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of our function if we think that we have no moral or ethical role to play. We absolutely do.
And for police lawyers and other lawyers who represent public sector agencies, there are model litigant policies that they have to comply with as well. And I do question, certainly in my case, how seriously that was complied with, or if at all, or really at the forefront of their minds.
Yeah, the model litigant rules have been in place for a long time. And in another context, we've prosecuted a lot of cases involving refugees against the Commonwealth. My observation of how the Commonwealth, certainly in the past decade, has conducted itself and how its lawyers have often conducted its cases fall a long way short of that standard.
I am in the very unique position as someone who made a criminal complaint of sexual assault or a victim of a crime to have also seen the criminal brief of evidence and had access to it. And I'm shocked that there were statements given that could even vaguely consider judgments of my character based on my clothing and my appearance. How can the police prevent that from happening again? Surely that's law 101 in the 21st century.
I mean, yeah, obviously evidence of that nature shouldn't have found its way into the brief. It should have been rejected. I mean, and obviously the police have to go wide in their investigation and typically will come up with a whole pile of evidence, some of which is relevant, some of which isn't. In the context of sexual assault cases, a lot of changes have been made over time in terms of the evidence that can be presented. Most famously, in rape cases, the defence can't raise prior sexual history anymore, which is used to be their main line of defence. But there's no similar rule in relation to what the complainant was wearing or how much they drank or what their behaviour was like. And that kind of, dare I say, slut-shaming carry-on is still a very prevalent part of cases. Nevertheless, the evidence that you discovered in your file is clearly inadmissible and irrelevant. And to think that that was playing any part in the decision-making of the police themselves is pretty disconcerting.
It's more than that. Like, for me, it's quite simple, because that aspect of taking statements from people is taught at the police academy. You can't insert opinions and hearsay evidence. Police are taught that from day dot, that can't go in. So when I hear about what happened to you with your witness statements or the witnesses in your matter, that smells to me that they were steering the investigation in a particular way, lacing it with prejudice, because they're taught not to do that. So
yes, well, Mark, I'm being kind when I characterise it as perhaps incompetence or ignorance or lack of training, but there was fabricated evidence, it was deliberate cover-ups.
Yeah, I think given those perspectives, I think there's plenty of reason to be suspicious about what happened in your case in particular. And that kind of comes back to that central conflict problem that the police were investigating themselves. You're entitled to draw the conclusions that you're drawing.
Non-disclosure agreements, or NDAs in short, as we know them by, and gag laws. What needs to change in terms of NDAs and gag laws?
Yeah, it's a hot topic. So with NDAs, there's been a sort of trend for a long time in the law that when someone comes forward with a claim or a grievance, and in an institutional or corporate context, and the institution wants to get rid of that, the price is money and the payback is an NDA. So they buy silence. And, you know, certainly like in, for example, with sexual harassment and sexual misconduct, it had become completely routine that if you're a victim and you step forward and you make a claim, the only way you're going to get a resolution is giving an NDA in return and being silenced contractually. That is, from a public interest perspective, a public policy perspective, completely wrong and always was. And that it's a tide that has sort of started to turn the other way. So increasingly people in that situation, and you're a great example of this, who's, you know, you've brought your claim for what happened to you in a civil suit and you've said, I'm not giving an NDA. Whatever the outcome of this is, it's not going to include me being silenced. And more, certainly like sexual assault survivors and sexual harassment survivors are starting to say exactly that. Silencing is not part of the deal here. That is not part of what I need and want. And in fact, it is clear that the public interest is not served by silencing.
My view is that it's about choice, the choice to speak up or the choice to have confidentiality and anonymity, and some complainants, that is what they want and prefer. And so certainly for me, from the beginning, an NDA and buying my silence was completely off the table. How did the police, my former employer, respond to that from me? Well, they had no choice about it. I went to the media before we even started properly negotiating. I showed them through my actions and not my words what was of high value to me. It's about values and priorities. Compensation was important to me. I had pursued my rights at significant legal cost and personal cost, and so to protect my family and to ensure my family were provided for. I mean, I'd lost my job. I'd lost my job as a result of speaking up, so money was important. But for me, my silence couldn't be bought. Do you have any reflections on that, Michael?
Well, yeah, I think the important thing to understand is, you know, what are we silencing and whose choice should that be? So your story, your identity, your choice. Nobody but you should have the power or the right to make public either of those things. That's your property. I think it is wrong as a matter of public policy for an NDA to be enforceable in the context of criminal wrongdoing. That just doesn't make sense to me as a lawyer. But I hear the counter-argument to that, that really that should be a choice for the individual and we shouldn't legislate out their right to effectively trade silence for money, if that's their choice. Well, I guess I worry about the coercive power of institutions and the effect of taking transparency off the table and how that had developed, where it really, in a way, everyone had been trained to think that talking publicly about what's happened to you is not an option, that the only avenue is either go to the cops or negotiate a settlement on the terms of silence. And no public interest has been served by that. I mean, I've worked with quite a lot of people who've entered into NDAs in contexts of sexual violence or sexual harassment and then subsequently really, really regretted it. But at the time felt they didn't have a choice. Sometimes they've had legal advice and the legal advice has been, yeah, you should sign an NDA because otherwise you're not going to get the money. And I'm like, that is not advice I would ever give, but I get it. But I think it's really unfortunate that I keep encountering people who are subject to NDAs that they now regret that they'd ever signed. One situation, which is pretty high profile, where we actually negotiated out of an NDA with an institution because they realised they'd done the wrong thing. That's rare, but it was very heartening, and it's kind of makes me a bit optimistic that there are some institutions who are within themselves starting to change their perspective and their view on what their responsibility is, which does not include silencing their own victims.
And when you sign up to an NDA, how can you then get out of it if you change your mind later?
I mean, it's always possible to renegotiate, but rare. Definitely a situation for getting legal advice, because very often NDAs don't do what everyone thinks they do. Like, they're very hard to enforce, actually, because the courts interpret them very strictly against the interest of the person who's enforcing them. So many, many times when we look at a confidentiality agreement or an NDA, it doesn't say what everyone thought it said, and often leaves a gap you could drive a truck through. So it's not necessarily the case that you're as silenced as you think. So that's always worth exploring. There is a very viable argument that, for example, an NDA in the context of rape, say, would be unenforceable as a matter of law. There is a principle of public policy that the courts enforce that says a contract which offends public policy is unenforceable. My personal view is that a contract which silences a rape allegation fits that category.
What's your best advice for would-be whistleblowers and witnesses in legal proceedings, and how much do you think timing has to do with decision-making?
I think that, you know, as I said earlier, the most important thing is to understand your own drivers. Like, what are you trying to achieve? What looks like an acceptable outcome? Not success, because that doesn't exist, but an acceptable outcome that will enable you to rest easy and say, well, I did what I needed to do, and to try to cut out all the noise, because when you're in that situation, there's no end to people who will tell you what you should or shouldn't do. And there's lots of social pressures and kind of assumptions around, oh, well, you know, this has happened to you, therefore you should do X. But there's no right or wrong about that. And I think that, yeah, it's really important to carve out the time and space to get yourself into a situation where you are mentally capable and sufficiently informed to make good choices about what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. And you have to prioritise your well-being in that above everything else. I mean, nobody else's interests should enter into the race.
You mentioned before that laws surrounding whistleblowers in Australia are inadequate or not good. Mm. So what protections are there for someone who does choose to speak out in this context against wrongdoing?
Precious few. It's dangerous to speak out, particularly when you're placing yourself at odds with a powerful institution like the police, who have immense coercive power of their own, but they also have enormous reservoirs of public trust, and all sides of politics back them. So you don't go up against an institution like that lightly, and you have very little protection in reality. I mean, ultimately, you've got the truth on your side.
Well, that's formidable in many cases, but sometimes it's not enough.
Yeah, you know, and being bankrupt or languishing in jail while holding on to the truth is not particularly an attractive proposition. I mean, nobody can tell you what to do. I think a person in either of your situations as examples would be completely justified in going to ground or leaving the country and changing your name and just getting away from all of it. Now, that's not to say that's the right thing to do either. And this is something I say to survivors all the time, is you don't owe anything to anyone. But there's this sort of thing going on at the moment where, because of the courage of people who've come forward, that it's kind of becoming an onus. It's like, oh, well, you have to step forward and speak. There's a social obligation to put yourself up on the cross and sacrifice yourself in the greater public interest of this conversation progressing and us getting to those sunny uplands together one day. But the price that survivors and victims of institutional wrongdoing pay is incalculable, and nobody can ask them to pay that price. It is wrong to do so.
I totally agree that it's wrong to expect that onus. And let's face it, I was able to seek justice that was in line with my values and what I wanted. And I felt the duty to speak up and take the fight because I knew what a unique and privileged position that I was in as a sexual assault victim, but also as an employee of the New South Wales Police Force, but also as a lawyer. I didn't join law school to one day advocate for myself in my own sexual assault case. And so if someone wants to seek compelled outcomes through the legal system, what resources does someone need to do that, to seek those outcomes?
Primarily, you need really good legal advice, and I'm not saying that as a selling pitch. It is such a minefield because the system is so poorly designed. I mean, whichever angle you look at it from, whether you look at it from the perspective of the balance between the right to free speech and the right to personal reputation, completely out of whack. If you look at the criminal justice system and how it deals with sexual violence, completely out of whack. Like, just wrong, the wrong system. So, you know, what that means is that when you're in that situation of being the victim of something having gone wrong and you feel compelled to do something about it, to speak up and act on it, it's treacherous. So you need guidance and you need support to make your way through that. Otherwise, yeah, you can get eaten alive pretty quickly.
Specifically, what are the legal risks of speaking up?
Sure. So you've got the risk of being sued for defamation by anyone you name or is identifiable, and if you've accused them of something that damages their reputation, then they can come after you. And that's a really high risk in Australia because we are the defamation capital of the world, not a badge of pride. You've got contractual risks. So if you're an employee, you know, like in Mark's position, he has contractual obligations as an employee. There are general obligations of confidentiality. There might be very specific contractual or statutory obligations in particular areas. So police have some specific obligations around secrecy that constrain them. Some of those are justified, some not so much. We've got all sorts of suppression laws, both statutory suppression, court-ordered suppression that impede the public interest. So the risks are many in terms of personal liberty.
So, Michael, before we wrap up, I'm curious to get your thoughts on if there's better ways to seek restitution other than the law.
Yeah, I think sometimes there are. I think the law's pretty clunky. It doesn't always provide good solutions, certainly in the areas we've been talking about here. Sometimes self-help is actually a better option. Like I say, when I talk to survivors, I take them through three options. One is going to the police, one is civil action, and the other is going public. And, you know, that carries its own risks, and it's something you have to be very mindful of those risks if you're going to do that. So that is exactly, you know, both of you have pursued legal avenues, and now you're pursuing public disclosure as a choice because you're dissatisfied with what those legal avenues have delivered in effect. So that's a conscious choice, in my view, well made. And certainly I know from our work together that you're extremely mindful of the legal risks, and you're trying to do this in a way that both protects you from those risks but also serves the public interest that you're keen to deliver on. And the legal processes that are available are not always the best means of achieving that.
Michael Bradley, managing partner of Mark Lawyers there. And we'll continue this discussion with Michael in our final episode, which focuses on ideas for positive change within the New South Wales Police Force and the legal system more generally. And we'll be bringing back our previous guests, Quentin Dempster, investigative journalist, and Lynn Worsley, clinical psychologist, to join in.
So the show today was devised by us, Mark Davidson and Lynn Nguyen. The executive producer is Gretchen Miller, with the sound engineering from Judy Rapley.
Don't forget, a couple of good places to head if you need advice in any area we've discussed is Whistleblowers Australia, or call 1800 737 732. That's 1-800-RESPECT, the National Sexual Assault, Family and Domestic Violence Counselling Line here in Australia. Thanks for staying with us, and take care.
Bye for now.